Well, this is a really, really good book, and I just hope I don't mess it up. It's a complicated book, however, and it takes a while to get your mental arms around it. And so I would encourage you just to kind of stay with me. I say that because I don't think I do this lecture very well. It's a complex thing. You just have to stay with me all the way through. And trust me, I think it'll be one of those books that really changes your view about who God is. It certainly has for me. But let's start out on a slightly lighter note. And you tell me, have you ever seen a situation like this before? Is this a picture of you and your high school friends? And if so, which one would you be? I would be the guy tied around the rock at the top, I think. Or what if Colonel Sanders got to heaven and realized, ooh, God really likes chickens? Okay, it's dumb, but I thought you'd like it. And this next one, oh, I can't show you that one. I got to go on. Maybe I'll show it to you. So then I says to Borg, you know, as long as we're under siege, one of us ought to moon these Saxon dogs. Okay, I'm sorry. Here, we'll clean this up. There. For those of you that are offended, now it's...
No, it's really bloody.
It's orphan. That's right, it's bloody. Ooh, didn't think about the red. It's rated BG. Okay. Okay, anybody like The Wizard of Id? Not the real popular one, I suppose, but I always liked the little king and his pink or purple leotards. Doctor always says to him, cut out salt, cut out sweets, cut out smoking, and cut out booze. Poor little king doesn't know what to do and says, what else is there to live for? Nah, I don't know, but if you come up with anything, scratch it. Okay, well, you laugh more than most people did. That's good. But the thing that's not really funny about this joke is this. I'm afraid that there are some people who think that that doctor in the white lab coat is a pretty good picture of what God is like. We would never say it out loud like that. It wouldn't be spiritually, politically correct in this place to say it. But I think there are some of us who are afraid, if I really did go to God and really submitted my life to Him and He diagnosed what was wrong and gave a solution, His prescription would be to take all the fun out of life as I now know it. Even as Dr. Brown mentioned in chapel, sometimes we talk about surrender, as though you surrender your life to God and you go down in great defeat. Maybe that's the reason why down deep inside, some of us have an assumption, I'm really not quite committed to God, and there are parts of my life I'm holding out because I'm afraid if I really did give it over to Him, this is what He'd do with it. And a lot of this goes to how you conceive of God and what you think God is like. Or to phrase the question a different way, you might ask it like this. Would God fit in my circle of friends? Let's pretend that it's Friday night, you're in the parking lot, everybody is jumping into the car, and you're about ready to go and do whatever you're going to do to have entertainment or enjoy time with your friends on Friday night, and there's a knock, and God shows up at the car door and says, hey, can I go too? What would happen to the party then? Would it be enhanced or would it be ruined? And the way you answer that question, I'm not trying to comment on what kind of friends you're hanging out with or necessarily your own spiritual life. I'm really trying to comment on what is it you conceive of God to be like? What is He like? Would He ruin it or would He enhance it? Would He make it better? Or to say it even a slightly different way, would God be any fun as a friend? And some of us are even asking the question, is it the right to ask such questions? Is it sacrilegious to ask those kind of questions? And I would submit to you that it's not wrong to ask those questions. Yes, He is God and Master and Savior and all those things, but the question is, what is He like up close? Because that, in fact, is our destiny. John chapter 14, as we said before, says, if you keep my commandments, I and the Father will make our home with you. So, you know, instead of just think about it in terms of pious platitudes, let's ask ourselves, do you really want God living in your house? Do you really? Or would you say to yourself, no, that makes me uncomfortable. I'm not sure that I'd like God living in my house. Well, we ought to think about that seriously, because that's what John 14 talks about. Not only the end of the verse, the end of the chapter right there, but the beginning of the chapter. If I go to prepare a place for you, in my Father's house are many rooms. It's about living with God. So are we going to be comfortable with him or are we not? And a lot of it goes directly to the question, what is he like? What does he want for us? What would he be like to relate to? So Ecclesiastes talks a lot about that, and that's where I'd like to go to now, all right? But in order to understand Ecclesiastes, you have to understand a little bit of my thought processes in dealing with the book. This is not an easy book to understand, and I have to kind of move you along my progress of thinking to show you where I am today. So I want to start right here with Bruce Waltke, who was quite a Hebrew scholar, taught at Dallas Seminary for years and went to Westminster Seminary. This is a really, an authority in the area of Hebrew scriptures and knows the book. And his opinion about Ecclesiastes is it's the most misunderstood book in the entire Bible. And he may be right about that. It is awfully difficult to understand. I mean, frankly, as you've read through it, when Solomon says things like, you know, as the beast dies, so you also die. There's no difference between the two. And, just an awful lot of discouraging things in there. And in fact, the NIV uses the word meaningless all the time. So you're wondering, what is the world with this book? What does it mean? Well, some people have their ideas. Some people say it's the product of the thinking man who comes to despair. Since life is so futile, he must have faith. Just the idea that, boy, you look at life and it seems so rough. We're just hoping that somehow God has some answers. Kind of a leap of faith. Nothing, can't be real sure what we're jumping into. Or there's the view of the old Scofield Reference Bible, which is pretty significant. I'll explain to you why in a second. The old Scofield Reference Bible says, these are conclusions and reasonings of a man, not truth from God. What they're saying is, this is a good example of how not to think. They would say it's like truthfully recorded error, like Satan's lies in Genesis 3. You know what I mean? Oh, yes, if you go ahead and eat that, you'll be as wise as God. Is that true? No, it's a big lie. Is it inspired? Well, yeah, because it's accurately recorded error. And so that's what they're saying here about Ecclesiastes. It's a real good example of how not to think. This is man's best idea of thinking, and it's wrong. And so here's an example of how, what not to do. Now, the reason why the old Scofield Reference Bible is important is because of this. When I got out of high school and went to college in the early 70s, I wanted to get a really good study Bible to take with me. And I had two choices, and only two choices. I could get a red Scofield Reference Bible, or I could get a black Scofield Reference Bible. And that was it. I know that's hard to imagine. As you go into a Christian bookstore today, there's 55 different study Bibles, all kinds of helps, but that isn't the way it was historically. I'd say from 1917, when the old Scofield Reference Bible first came out, all the way through the 70s, it was the Bible of choice across the country and in some places the world for serious laymen who wanted to know God's Word. This was the study Bible they would get. So generation after generation grew up with this kind of thinking, that Ecclesiastes really shouldn't be taken too seriously. It's just a good example of how not to think. Well, that didn't sit very well with me when I started to teach this book some 20 years ago. And so I did a lot of reading, a lot of different commentaries, and they're all very discouraging until I came... I'm getting ahead of myself here. The reason I had a problem with that thinking of the Scofield Reference Bible is that Solomon is the author. Chapter 1 of verse 1 says, the son of David... doesn't actually say Solomon, but it's the son of David who's king in Jerusalem, so that pretty well narrowed it down for me. And number one, it says he's the author, and I don't think he's going to be writing error. Number two, and more powerfully, the conclusion of the book says these are delightful words and words of truth. So it claims that this is not a wrong way to think, but the right way to think. And then to make matters worse, it says they're like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. The image in Hebrew is a huge spike that's nailed into the wall that you can hang your coat on. This is a piece of truth you can hang your life on. Given by one shepherd. Now, it doesn't take a barrel of brains in the Old Testament to figure out who the one shepherd is, right? Psalm 23. Yahweh is the one shepherd. So the book claims here that these are inspired thoughts from God to teach us how to live. So how are you going to take them? Well, as I said before, now catch up with myself. I read through a number of commentaries that were fairly negative and didn't seem to really honor the idea that this was truth from God until I got to this book by Walter Kaiser. Now, I don't know if you remember that name. He came and spoke in chapel one time last year. A fairly older gentleman, talked about the Old Testament. He's kind of a funny guy. And he wrote this commentary on Ecclesiastes. It's just a paperback book, 120 pages or something, you know, so in, as you compare things academically, it's not nearly as long or didn't seem as academic as some of the other commentaries. So I didn't quite take it seriously at the start. It didn't cost very much, paperback. How much truth can there be here? And then I got a hold of the thing and I said, man, this is really different. This is a very, very good little book. And I really, really liked how Walt Kaiser took Ecclesiastes. It was very different than anything I'd ever seen before. And let me summarize his ideas for you. He said this, that if you were to take Solomon's life and to chart it out, and you can do that, when Solomon first started to reign was in 970 BC, and going backwards, he dies 40 years later in 930 BC. If you took his life and you charted it out as on the scale of near to God or far from God, how would you draw in the chart? Where does he start and where does he finish? Does he start close or far away from God? Starts pretty close, doesn't he? All right, because when he becomes king, he says, God, what do you want me to do? And God says, I'll grant you anything you want. And he says, what I want more than anything is wisdom. And God says, man, that's really smart. And he gives it to him. All right, so he starts close to God. Where does he finish? He finishes far away from God. He does some pretty ugly things. He worships some foreign gods. And why does he do that?
Because
he married some foreign women who drew his heart away from God. Exactly. If you chart his life out, it really goes downhill like this. And we talked about why it goes downhill when we discussed Deuteronomy chapter 17. Do you remember the connection with Deuteronomy 17? What's Deuteronomy 17 about? Any ideas? Anybody remember?
What the kings are to do. Exactly.
If a king really wants to love God and wants his people to love God, then he's got to do four things. He's got to get his copy of Deuteronomy and read it every day, number one. And then what were the other three things? You remember? Not allowed to have a lot of wives was one of them, and can't have horses and gold and wives. Why not? Remember why? Because God doesn't like any of those things. No. The horses was because this is a way a king would provide political and military security. And God says, I don't want your security to be found in weapons of warfare. I want your security to be found in me. So don't multiply lots of horses. Well, when the Pharaoh in Egypt had his elite force of charioteers, there were 600 of them. It's estimated that Solomon had over 12,000 horses in his stables. In fact, he created stables for horses in some important cities like Megiddo and other places, and the foundations for those things are still there today. The guy had all kinds of horses. It said multiply gold. He had so much gold that they made weapons of warfare out of it, shields out of it. That's, you know, like making grenades out of gold. How dumb can you be? And the wives thing, we don't need to go into that, I guess. 1,000. And what is it? 700 wives and 300 concubines, or maybe it's 300 wives and 700 concubines? How do you tell the difference after all? I mean, does it make any difference? Can you imagine what it's like for a guy living like that? You're walking downtown, you see a woman. Hi, how are you? Who are you? Well, I'm one of your wives. I'm sorry, I didn't recognize you. You've got 1,000 of them. How do you know? I mean, think of all the curling irons in the bathroom. That's what amazes me. Think, how's a guy going to live like that? But all of those things, it says in the scriptures that his wives brought their foreign gods with them, and he drew his heart away from God. So he really gets far away from God. Now, Kaiser goes on to speculate, and I think he's right, because 1 Kings chapter 11 says God sent discipline against him, sent armies to discipline him to slap him upside the head and to get his heart right. And so what Kaiser theorizes is that towards the very end of his life, he comes back to God. And it's at this point right here that he writes the book of Ecclesiastes. So Ecclesiastes is a book written by an older guy who's saying, okay, I've got a lot of life history to look at here, and let me just look back over it and draw some conclusions for you. I've looked at life from two perspectives, from being close to God and from being far away from God, and let me compare the two for you. Now, he is absolutely right about this. This is true. I'm not quite sure where Kaiser goes from here, but this part is true. He writes the book towards the end of his life, as sort of an instructive testimony for people who have not finished their lives, who are in the midst of their lives. So what he does is he kind of summarizes what it's like to be close to God and far away from God and contrast those two. And the summary is right here in 2:24 to 26. Now let me read for you what 2:24 to 26 says, all right? So something like this. There's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. And his point is that when you are walking closely with God, when you are near to God, God will allow you to enjoy life. This is from the hand of God. The ability to eat and to drink and to say, man, I enjoy my work. This is a gift from God that you get when you are near to him, right? As he goes on, who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? Unless God is a part of your life, you're not going to be able to enjoy life. So far, so good. And then he goes on and says this. For a person who is good in his sight, he's given wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to the sinner, he is given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give to the one who is good in God's sight. So he's contrasting the white part, the good part, the being near to God part, with the yellow part, which is what you get if you are far away from God. You with me? I'm thinking in terms of the chart here. So if you're close to God, you enjoy life. If you're far away from God, you will not enjoy life. In fact, all of life will be vanity to you. So to go back here, it looks like this. Up here is how you enjoy life. Down here is what you experience if you're far away from God. Solomon says that's what it was like for me. Close to God, abundant life. Far away from God, not so good. Lots of vanity. Now, let's just take a little pause here, take a little break, and tell me how you respond to that. Do you like that? Does it look good? Does it seem to fit? Does it seem to be true? As you look at life, both your experience and the experience of other people, does that seem true? I don't know about you. Sure seems pretty true to me. I know that when I'm living close to God, life seems a whole lot better than when I'm far away from God. And when you're far away from God, there's guilt and trouble and discipline, and I don't like that at all. I also like to think of it in terms on the broader scale of unbelievers as well, that there are people who are at the top of the world, as the world thinks of it, but really deep inside, their experience is probably hopelessness and emptiness and thirst, and they may appear to have it all together on the outside, but inside they're, you know, probably crumbling or without hope, as the example from John Lennon spoke about so clearly today. I don't know if that struck you or not. The only time we used drugs was when we were without hope. Right? And how many times did they use drugs? I don't know. Seems like it was hard to find the Beatles not on drugs. But anyway, different discussion. So anyway, I look at that and I think, yeah, there's an awful lot of truth that I think I really like that. So I began to teach the book this way. And I would move through the book and enjoyed it and made an awful lot of sense. But the more and more I would do that, there were a couple little things that would annoy me and would bother me. And I'd say, well, wait, that doesn't quite fit. And here's what I'm talking about. There were some problems with that idea. And one of them was this, that vanity or meaninglessness, as the NIV translates, I think that's a bad translation, I'll tell you why in a second. But this idea of vanity, which shows up throughout the book, or meaninglessness, is used most of the time to refer to all people, not just the sinner. You see a problem with that? Because in Kaiser's viewpoint, vanity is only what you get if you're the sinner. If you're close to God, vanity isn't a part of your life, just enjoyment. But as the scripture uses it in Ecclesiastes, vanity applies to everybody. For example, chapter 11, verse 8. If a man lives many years and rejoice in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. All that comes is vanity. So if a guy lives a long time, the older he gets, all that is coming, all that is in the future is vanity. Now, does that square with what Kaiser has said? The answer is no, because the older, what this would be saying is, the older you get, the further away you get from God. That isn't the way it's supposed to work, is it? I mean, it might have worked in Solomon's life, but it's not supposed to work that way in ours. I mean, the older you get, the more your body breaks down, but all of the New Testament and the Old Testament, too, screams that even though the outer man wastes away, the inner man is being renewed and becoming more and more like him, that the older we get, the closer we ought to get to God. So it doesn't really quite fit. Because what we see is that vanity doesn't just fit down here in the lower levels, but vanity actually is a part of the person who is living up here on this level as well. At least the word vanity is used an awful lot to describe even these people who live up close to God. You might wonder why I'm telling you all this, but I just have to kind of trace the history so you understand where I am in this book. So here's another verse that says the same thing. Chapter 12, 7 to 8. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it, obviously talking about dying. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. Now, again, according to Kaiser, this would have to be the experience, chapter 12, verses 7 to 8, would have to be the experience only of the unbeliever. But as we all know, it's not, right? I mean, all of us are going to die. So all of us are going to experience the vanity of death. So there's a lot of truth to what Kaiser had to say, but somehow he's not quite got the whole picture. In order to understand exactly what the book is talking about, I think we've got to focus on this idea of vanity. Okay? So let's do that. I don't know how you conceive of it. You might think of when you're so vain, you probably think the song is about you. Carly Simon or old 80s tunes come to mind. But vanity doesn't have to do with looking in the mirror and thinking nicely of yourself. Okay? Here's some dictionary, some Hebrew definitions of the word. And from the dictionary, the first thing it means or does not mean is meaningless. It does not mean meaningless or purposelessness. And it's really unfortunate that the NIV translates the word that way every time. I don't know why in the world they did it, but if you're using the NIV, you've got to train yourself not to say the word meaningless, but to say something else. And I'll give you something else to replace it with in a second. But it doesn't mean that. It has the idea of transience. Like it's here for a while and then it's gone. It also has the idea of the word perplexity. Like it's difficult to solve. It's a problem you can't quite figure out. Or even the word vapor. Again, like on a cold day, you see your breath and then it's gone. Those are all not bad ways to think of the meaning of this word. But to really understand what it means, it's a good idea to take a look at other scriptures as well. And there are three passages we want to look at. Romans 8, Genesis 3, and Ecclesiastes chapter 3. We're going to look at those passages and see how they use this word and see if it gives us some insight into how we should understand the book of Ecclesiastes. Okay? So we're going to take a look at those three chapters in order, and we'll start with Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8 says this: I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. So he's talking about the present and the future when Christ comes back. The creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. Now, the sons of God to be revealed for who we really are. When we get rid of our sinfulness and we can function as we're supposed to be, that's what the creation is looking forward to. For the creation was subjected to vanity, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. Now, I think you understand what's going on here in 18 to 21. You have to understand what we discussed in Genesis 3 to get it, but I think you probably understand that. Remember? We talked about God being up here, man being here, and earth being down here. And when man rebels against God, then what happens? God allows the earth to rebel against man. That's part of the curse. Now, the earth doesn't want to do that. In fact, as Paul talks about it here in Romans chapter 8, the creation itself kind of groans and says, oh, we don't like doing this. This is really bad. We really want to do what we were intended to do, and that is to serve mankind. But right now, we are under this vanity, and probably the easiest synonym to use is curse. We're under this curse, and we can't wait to get out from under the curse, and as soon as mankind gets right, then we can live right or do what we're supposed to do too. Right? So, the big idea, I guess, is this, that the word vanity is used in reference to the curse. Genesis chapter 3. Yeah, in case you missed it, that's the summary. Vanity equals the curse. Genesis chapter 3. Then to Adam he said, cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall grow for you, By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Now, when we looked at that portion in Genesis 3, you can kind of separate two things out. There are two really bad things there that happen. The first has to do with the ground and work becoming toil and life becoming harder. But the second thing is even worse than that. What's the second thing up there? Death, exactly. Okay, life is going to become really miserable, and then it's going to end. So those are two parts of the curse here, difficulty and death. And notice that it's all finishes with, you are dust, and to dust you will return. Same phrase you can see in Ecclesiastes 3. It says this, for the fate of the sons of men and the fate of the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath. There's no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. Now, I don't want to talk, I'll talk about Solomon and his view of the afterlife later. Don't think that he doesn't think there's a future for people. He does. But the point I want to bring out from right here is simply that in the same way the animal dies, you're going to die too, for all is vanity. And he connects the idea of vanity with death and the curse. You see it here? You with me? Nod your head or open your eyes or something. Yeah, most of you are with me. All right, so that's the idea that like that stupid raccoon that got hit by the car and is laying along the side of the road, that dumb animal dies, you know, same thing is going to happen to all of us. We're all going to die too. And that, in terms of death, vanity, or the curse, is going to get you. All go to the same place, all came from dust, and all return to the dust. So I think you can see here, as you move through, vanity isn't just the lot of the unbeliever. Vanity is part of the curse, and who suffers from the curse? Believers or unbelievers? Trick question. Answer, all of us do, right? So, the way I would define the word then is this. When you say vanity, and this is key to going where we want to go in the book, vanity means futility and frustration and limitation and ultimately death, which every person experiences as a result of living in a sin-cursed world. So get that definition in your head, because you've got to have it there to understand what's going on. You also have to have it to be able to read the NIV and understand it correctly. Or if you just want to write this out succinctly, I would say life as a result of the curse. So, let's brainstorm just for a second, as soon as you finish writing. I hope you can finish writing. Is it distracting for you to write and for me to talk to? Okay, you've learned to do that already. So what does that mean in real practical terms? Just name, well, we won't do 100, but we could do 100. Name some things that describe this. Life as a result of the curse. How is life different for us now than it was for Adam and Eve in the garden? We have what that they don't have? Sickness, viruses, flat tires, broken relationships, bad breath. Seriously. All that stuff that comes as a result of the curse. All those annoying things. Getting older, your body breaking down, broken relationships. All that stuff that comes to us as part of the curse. And we don't often think about it a lot because we simply live in the midst of it. So sometimes you get used to it. But every once in a while, the curse will hit you straight in the face. It'll hit you in the face when you hear things like, we got a phone call from the doctor and your mother has cancer. Or, we're sorry, there was a serious accident last night and your best friend was killed in a car wreck. Times like that, when the curse just comes and hits you in a way where you can't avoid it. And I know that this is one of those books that I'm not sure how much it'll reach out and grab you because of where you are in life right now. Because I know that most of you who are 20 or 21 are absolutely immortal and invincible. I know, that's what we're like when we're 20. You never think about dying. You're not going to die. You're going to live forever. You haven't felt the effects of the curse weighing down or broken bodies, and you just have this sense you're going to live forever. But Solomon is towards the end of his life, and he's saying, you know what? I realized I'm not, and I've lived through experiences where the curse hit me in the face, and it's wrong. And when those times come to you, you begin to ask these kind of questions like, why? Why is it so wrong? Why is life like this? If this is how life is, then how good a God can he be? Do I want him to be my friend or not if he allows life like this? And that's the kind of issue that drives Solomon, and that's where he's going in this book. So what is he asking? Well, what his goal is then to show us how to approach life after Eden and before the millennium. Now, we know that Eden was a utopian situation, right? Things were good. You didn't have the curse there. We know that the kingdom is going to be like that too. When Christ comes back and he sets things correctly, life is going to be good. But in some ways, it's a simplistic answer to simply say, well, life is going to be there better then, and let's just, realize that he's in a better place, and if he could come back, he wouldn't want to come back. Solomon says, let's talk about living life right now. How do we live life now in the midst of trouble and oppression and disease and death? I know there's a future life. I know things are going to get better. But how do we live life right now, before the millennium? So what he's going to say is, how do I approach life during this curse? Well, God's design for man in a sin-cursed world is that man do two things. The first one is not too difficult to imagine. It is, God wants us to obey him. Is it man in that sense? Oh, it's not. Man wants us to, or God wants us to obey him, as you could probably guess. And number two, as you probably wouldn't guess, God wants us to enjoy our vain or currently cursed life. God really, really does want you to enjoy life even now, even in the midst of the curse. All kinds of people have all kinds of responses to the curse and to the difficulty and to the pain of life. And a lot of our lives are motivated by trying to get away from this. Anybody here seen, it's kind of old now, it's in the dollar theaters, have seen The Village by M. Night Shyamalan? Really fascinating study in a group of people who determined to get away from the pain of the curse and the violence in the world, which is a result of the curse. I wish you'd all seen it. I'd love to talk with you about it, about our own Christian responses to the difficulties of the world and how we isolate ourselves from the pain. How Christians have left the cities and moved to the suburbs in order to get away from the pain and the difficulties of life. And we don't even think about it, and we should think about it very carefully. What if Jesus had determined simply to avoid pain? He never would have come to the earth. There's just so much rich thinking to be done here. I hope I can communicate this to you clearly. Let me walk you through the survey here. And in the first 11 verses, Solomon tries to teach us about his big idea. And he introduces the problem. And the major point is found in chapter 1 and verse 2. You don't have to open your Bibles. I'll just read it for you unless you've got it open. He says this, "Vanity of vanities, says the teacher, all is vanity, vanity of vanities." 5 times he uses the word vanity. Now, again, it doesn't take a whole lot of brains to figure out he's trying to emphasize this idea of vanity. And if you understand it correctly, he does not mean meaninglessness. He simply means the curse is all around. And I think what he's trying to say is that all of life is affected by the curse. You cannot avoid it. You can't get away from it. All of life is affected by the curse. You say, well, what do you mean by that? Would you explain yourself? So he says, sure. Here's my explanation. Verse 3. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? A generation comes, a generation goes, but the earth remains forever. Now, when you come to Ecclesiastes, a lot of people, you know, are a little discouraged by it, don't understand it, but they are intrigued by some of the nice poetry, like, you know, it's a time to be born, time to die, time to sing, time to dance, time to love, time to hate, and those kind of things they remember. And they kind of take these statements that Solomon makes here like trite little truisms. Generation comes, generation goes, but the earth remains forever. I don't think that's how Solomon meant it. I think Solomon, when he said verse 4, was really about as ticked off as he could be. I think he was angry. I think if Solomon were here and he would read this to us, it would have a very angry tone to it. And he would say something like, a generation comes and a generation goes, but the earth remains forever. Why would Solomon say something like that? Do you understand why he would be angry? What is so wrong with verse 4? If you're catching his perspective, you understand he thinks this is a bad thing. Do you understand why?
It was never supposed to be like that, that a generation comes and a generation goes.
It was never supposed to be that a generation would come and a generation would go. Why? Because in the beginning, God created it, pardon the crummy clip art, God created it like this. This is supposed to represent Genesis chapter 1, that the first 6 days were all about creating this environment here, the earth, but mankind was the crowning creation of it on day 6. The earth isn't the important thing. The earth is just the environment where man lives. What's really important is this person created, or this race created in the image of God, which rules over the entire earth and subdues it and has glory and lasts forever. Death is such an aberration. It's such an intruder. It's not supposed to be there. This is the way it was supposed to be. The problem is Solomon looks at life and says, this is now what it looks like. Right? The earth just keeps going and going and going, and the one who's supposed to rule over is sitting down here totally obscured by it because he's not around. Or to put it another way, death comes along and takes us away, and if we could quote Adam after Genesis 3, he might have said, it's really hard to rule over when you're 6 feet under. Okay? You seeing where we're going here? This is a problem. This is a serious problem. And again, you may just be sort of an abstract philosophical thing to you at this point, unless you've buried someone you really love. If you've ever looked into a coffin of someone you really love, then all of a sudden these questions become more real, and you say, why does death have to happen? It's always out of season. It's always wrong. Why? What is so desperately wrong right now? And somehow platitudes of, well, we'll see him again someday, ring rather hollow. Solomon says, okay, let me show you what I think is really wrong. The sun just keeps going. Let me read for you verse 5. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. And you look at that and think, wow, that's really deep. Sun rises and sun sets, hurries back to where it rises. Wow, I didn't know that. That's so amazing. Verse 6, the wind blows the south and turns the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. What do you know? Heavy. Wow. Ooh. Verse 7, all streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place where the streams come from, there they return again. Now, you look at this and think, okay, that's really deep, right? What's the point? And what he's trying to say is, the earth keeps going like the Energizer Bunny. It just keeps going and going and going and going. But there is a problem, and the problem in verse 11, this kind of wraps up his introduction, is this. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. Do you get that? Do you understand what the point is? What's the big problem here? There's no remembrance of men of old. Why not? Because they're dead, and people grow up who don't know about them, and he says it's just this tragic waste. Now, the very first time I ever taught this was in 1983, and the day we got to this verse, providentially I think, was November 22nd, 1983. And I had 400 people in the auditorium that I was teaching at that time, and I said, man, this is a really significant day for me. November 22nd, 1983, out of 400 people, when I asked them, why is this such a significant day, only 4 people out of 100 knew the answer. Do you know why November 22nd, 1983 would have been kind of a day that I took note of. Mary Jane knows why. No, it was close to that. It was close. Actually, she was born a little bit before that. Yeah, that was 20 years after the assassination of JFK. Now, I don't know if that means anything to you at all or not. Probably it means absolutely nothing to you. Because I said, man, this is a big day, and everybody in the audience 20 years later who weren't around when that happened said, oh really? You think it's a big day? You know, get over it. And I said to them, you don't understand. You don't have any idea what it's like for a president to be assassinated. This just changed everything. It was a huge time stop for a week in terms of the whole nation. All of the ceremony and everything that happened was just devastating. And everybody looked at me kind of like you're looking at me now, like, yeah, piece of history, big deal, who cares? Which is exactly the point. But let me bring it home a little bit closer. Do you realize that 20 years from now, you'll be trying to tell your children about this, and they'll say, yeah, big deal, Mom and Dad. Get over it. It happened. You say, No. No, you don't understand. When this happened, like 3,000 people died there. Like, time stopped for a week. And they'll say, yeah, but it started again, didn't it? It's like, get over it. And you begin to think, wait a minute, this is so wrong. That a generation comes, a generation goes, and people don't live forever. And this is something that's just completely wrong. And Solomon says, that's the essence of what the curse has brought us. How do we deal with that right now? A couple years ago, I was at this place, which is Masada. It is down near the Dead Sea in Israel. It's this impregnable fortress that you can hardly... Well, it's almost impossible for an enemy army to overtake it. That's why in 70 AD, 900 zealots and their children, total of 900 and families, went up here on top of this. That's where you're standing, is up on top of the fortress. And what you're looking down is a Roman camp, the outlines of a Roman camp that's 2,000 years old. And the zealots and their families went up there to hide from the Romans because they'd rebelled against Rome. And the Romans came and they besieged the place for 3 years. And the only way they overcame them was they literally moved a mountain to build a ramp so they could get up to it. And they had these elaborate cisterns on top where they would catch the rain. It was only like 2 inches of rain that would fall a year, but these cisterns, they caught the rain and they were able to grow grain and survive and thrive and even had more grain at the end of the 3 years than they did at the beginning. But when the time came for the Romans to breach the walls, everybody knew it was going to happen just because of the way events were progressing. The night before the Romans would have breached the walls and come in, they had this huge suicidal, homicidal pact, and what they did was all of the men went back to their own homes and slit the throats of their families. And then the men got together, and one guy slit the throats of all them, and that guy was then to fall on his sword. So when the Romans came in the next day, it was this very hollow victory. And they said, okay, you know, you're going to beat us, but you're not going to be the master of who takes our lives. We're going to take it ourselves. And so this has become this huge national monument, memorial, so that even today a lot of Jewish people, Jewish soldiers, are inducted into the army. They go to the bottom of this thing, and in their full gear with their guns, they race 1,300 feet to the top, and they're inducted in the army, and then they all raise their rifles, and they say, never again. And when they say never again, what they mean is never again will Masada fall to an outside enemy. So it's this really patriotic place in Israeli psyche. And while I was up there looking over Masada, I met this fellow named Max. Max was about a 75 or 80-year-old man who had lived through the Holocaust. He was a Jewish man, and he lived in Holland. And the Nazis came and took away his brothers and sisters and his parents, but there was a Christian couple who adopted him and pretended he wasn't a Jewish boy, he was a Christian boy, adopted him into their family, and he survived that way, but all of his family went to Auschwitz. We got to the top up here, and I met him, and I began to talk to him about Messiah. And so I said, you realize, Max, that the Old Testament, I was trying to just teach him about Messiah from the Old Testament, it's kind of a fun thing. And so do you realize that, Ezekiel and Isaiah say that all this area out here, when Messiah comes back, is going to bloom like a garden. It's going to be green like a garden because Messiah is going to transform things. And I talked to him about Isaiah 53, you know, about Jesus there, and went through the whole plan of salvation, and I could tell he was very attracted. But he couldn't get past one thing, and he asked me this statement. He said, "Where was bloody Messiah when we needed him?" If you've ever been to Europe or spent any time over there, you realize that bloody is a very vulgar term in European semantic range. It's a real, you know, it's a curse word. And what he was saying was, where was Messiah when we needed him? What he's talking about, of course, was the Holocaust. And his point was, how can Jesus be Messiah? How can God be God if he forsook us in the Holocaust? And the Holocaust is simply the curse incarnate. Couldn't get past it. And I didn't have a real good, quick answer for him, but I had to go at that point. I said, "Max, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you anymore. I've got to go be with my group because we're taking this tour around the top of Masada." And so this guy, this 80-year-old man, followed me for another hour while we were taking this tour, asking questions, because he was so attracted to the message. He really wanted to know about Messiah, but he couldn't get past the problem of evil, as we see it here. And that's exactly what Solomon is talking about. How are you going to deal with the problem of evil and what's happening here on earth? How do you reconcile that with the nature of God and who God is? Is he a good God or is he not? And so that's what he wants to talk about. And that's what we will do in Ecclesiastes when we get together tomorrow.